he was in the North Tower. His wife was in the South Tower, September 11, 2001. Bruce Steppen, thank you for coming on and telling us your story.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Bring us through your day.
Well, on September 11, 2001, my wife and I got up unusually early and actually made it to work a little early that day, just in time to get up to our floors, get to our desks, minutes before those planes would come into the buildings.
Had you been late, you would have missed that.
Exactly. Any other day, if we were on our normal time frame, we would not have been in the building. We would have been watching it from the street.
And what floor are you on in the North Tower? What floor is she on?
I had reported to work on the 72nd floor and then walked down to the 65th floor through the stairwells, something I did regularly to work on a different floor. So I actually got a little lower within the first few minutes of being at work, picked up my stuff and went downstairs. And then my wife was in the 91st floor of the other tower.
Okay.
Wow.
Those sound like high floors. We've talked to people on 25th, 30th, 35th floors. The difference between... Well, so what time did you arrive at the building? Because we know the first plane hit the North Tower at 8:46.
We probably got in about 8:30.
Wow.
So it was minutes before.
Minutes before.
Wow.
So you go to the 72nd floor and then go down to the 65th. And... at 8:46, when that plane hit, what did you feel or hear, or what was that sound like?
Well, I had just gotten up from my desk to go get water, you know, flipped up my laptop, turned it on, and walked over to the water cooler. And all of a sudden, I hear this explosion that sounds like a small bomb. No idea that it was a plane. It was just a really loud bang, and it was about 25 floors above me.
Now, years earlier, during the Clinton administration, there was another attempt on the World Trade Center. It was a van down in a parking garage. Were you there for that? And was that the first thing that clicked into your mind?
No, I was not there then. But bizarrely enough, my sister was there and had been working in the building.
That's amazing.
I didn't think of an attack at all. We had no idea what was happening. We just heard a loud bang. It could have been like a transformer going or something.
Right.
But then in the next second, there was the next thing I noticed was this kind of groaning noise, and you noticed that the building was swaying, and the building always moved a little bit. When you were up that high of a floor, it swayed back and forth. You could see the waves in the toilet pretty much. But this was really leaning. And then the next second, it was this tinkling sound. And it was coming from over by the windows. And you look out the windows, and there was flaming pieces of glass going by the window. And at that moment, someone yelled, "What do we do?" And I screamed, "Get to the stairs." So basically, I looked at my laptop on the desk and I said, "I'm not taking it."
Yep.
And I walked out to the elevator lobby and with everybody else on that floor, picked one of the four stairwells and started to just walk down the stairs.
Working in the building and on that floor, was there a regular drill or protocol for, a fire?
Anything.
Anything.
I recall that there was like regular fire drills and stuff like that. I mean, like maybe once a year, maybe twice a year.
It seems like you knew exactly what to do.
Yeah, head for the stairs.
Yeah.
Well, one of my tricks was to avoid the trouble with elevators that go only partway down through the building and takes you longer to get there. That's why I walked down. So I kind of knew where the stairs were, and, whoever walks first, everybody follows. So, yeah.
How long did it take to go from where you were down the stairs to the floor?
At least an hour.
Wow.
That's because everyone's flooding the stairwell, right?
Right, and then the firemen start coming up. So originally we're going down too wide. At some point, and everybody's very calm. And then at some point we stopped, and everyone, collectively, the whole stairwell goes, and, they look a little panicky, and then it starts to move again, and we're moving a lot slower, and then we start seeing firemen coming up through the building.
I remember NBC did a special months after this, And there was a documentary being filmed at the Trade Center Towers that day. And so they had cameras in the lobby as the firefighters were walking in. And you see these young men and older men just looking just overwhelmed. Like, we've fought all types of fires, never anything like this.
Yeah.
And then the footage of them walking up the stairs. That is the definition of bravery.
Yeah. The equipment and everything on them. The equipment, hoses.
Going up the stairs.
The hoses and everything, yeah.
You know. So at any point during your travel down the stairs, did you know that it was a terrorist attack or that it was an airplane?
We heard, and you know, cell phones weren't the same as they are today. They didn't work very well. So we had heard from other people, you know, everyone was kind of talking as you went. It might have been a plane. So, but we were thinking like the thing that happened back on the Empire State Building in World War II, you know, some small plane accidentally flies into the building.
Yeah.
And that was about as much information as we had going down the stairs. And you mentioned the firefighters. I did want to mention, when I finally got down all those stairs and came out of the mezzanine level, there was a rescue worker whose job was to scream at us, because we came out of the mezzanine, to keep moving. Go, go, go. And he pointed us to the next stair. And I ran right over to him because I'd heard about the plane. I was thinking a small chance that maybe a wing spun off and flew into my wife's building or something. But I wanted to kind of check up. And I said, you know, what happened? And he said, it was a plane. And I said, how's the other tower? And he said, it was two planes. And he kind of had this look on his face. And I just, my whole heart sunk, because I had no idea what was going on with Joan and the other thing. And, you know, I tried to call. My phone wouldn't work. He asked for my phone. I gave him my phone. He tried to call his family, and he couldn't get through either. And he said, listen, if I don't make it out of this building alive, he points to his name on his sleeve, and I don't remember what it was, but he said, if I don't make it out alive, get a hold of my family, let them know where I was, let them know what happened to me. But he was staying in that building just to be a traffic cop to direct us out that door. So that's the heroism you were talking about.
Yeah.
Wow. He already knew.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had no idea. I'm an engineer. I worked for the Port Authority who built that building. No idea that that thing could come down. No idea that that was the outcome. I mean, you figure if it was going to go, it went when the plane hit, not after.
Right. Yeah. So now you're out, and the South Tower, you learned, was also struck by a plane, and your wife is on the 91st floor the last time you knew anything. So what happens next?
So they route us down through the basement. The basement's somewhat flooded. The sprinkler systems are going off. They're yelling, run, run, run. There's people all along the way telling you to do that. I come out in the street. I try to look back, and well, one thing I saw was there were people jumping out off the building. The second thing I saw was that the flames were, I could pretty much tell where the, you know, the floors were by certain floors that had air conditioning on it. And the flames were below my wife's floor, and they were shooting up, you know, working their way up the building, and people were jumping out. And my wife always said, I don't mind dying, but I don't want to know what's coming. And I thought it couldn't have been any worse than what I'm seeing. And, you know, I had to go across the street to even look back and see that. I just wanted to get to a phone. Her parents lived in Manhattan. I wanted to give them a call and find out if she had called in, if she had made it out by some miracle. But as far as I knew, the planes hit at the same time. So I walked a few blocks. I managed to get to a building that I could get in that had a phone. I waited for one person, and I called. And I got a hold of someone at her mother's house. And I said, well, at least one of us made it out alive. And they said, oh, Joan got out a while ago. She called a half hour ago or so. So I collapsed pretty much on the floor. Then, you know, I tried to call my father, and I got a hold of him, and I told him, you know, what had happened and not to worry. And as I'm talking to him, I hear explosions. And at this point, I knew it was two planes. And then we had heard on the radio that there were seven planes that had been taken. You don't hear about this anymore, but there were seven planes on the radio announced. So I thought that those planes were flying over and bombing Manhattan or something. It was just bang, bang, bang. And of course, it was the second tower going down, the building my wife was in, but I only found that out later, and just collapsing, pancaking one floor upon the other floor. So I told my father, look, I got to go. I think they're bombing Lower Manhattan. I'll call you again when I can.
How far away were you, Bruce, from the towers at that point?
Only a couple blocks, like four or five blocks or something like that.
That ground was a shug, huh?
Oh, my God, yes. Everything was shaking. And so then the next thing I did is, like, run out the door to see what was going on, and it was like nuclear winter. It was, you know, originally a beautiful sunny day, and there's just the sky is filled with the ash. People are walking with dust 6 inches high on their shoulder, walking like it's just going home from work with a briefcase and stuff like that. It was the most bizarre thing.
How long did the banging, the pancaking of the building take? It probably felt like forever.
It didn't seem as long as one might think, I guess. You know, I remember it as going on, but I think, I'm not sure if it was still going on by the time I opened the door. It was so long ago. You know, I think it had already stopped by the time I hung up the phone and went outside, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like it had gone that fast, but it was, you know, took a little while, but not too long.
Yeah. At that point, your first thought must be, I hope she got out of the building, right?
Well,
or
now
did you
I'm
know
thinking,
she was already out?
No, I knew she was already out. So now my thought is, great. So I walk four blocks away to get a phone call in, and she's standing right next to the building looking for me. And she has the whole building fall on top of her or whatever. Once we realized what it was, you know, that she had left herself in harm's way and I somehow got out of harm's way. So that was my big fear. So at that point, I just walked up, you know, I went back into the synagogue, and basically we were told to leave. I left the building with everyone else. I'm breathing in the dust, and I'm going, this is crazy. We shouldn't leave. So I turned around, and the door had locked behind me, but it was big double doors, and I managed to pull the doors open somehow with that kind of super strength you get in panic or something. And then I just kept the doors like partly open and kept telling people to come in and save their lungs. And some rescue workers came in. They, you know, collapsed on the floor. We got water with paper towels and wiped their face and wiped their eyes down. And as soon as they could stand back up, they ran back out to help people.
Unbelievable.
And then eventually people from hospitals came out and they were handing out the kind of mask we're wearing all the time today with coronavirus. They were handing them out to people. And I figured, okay, let me go see what I could do to figure out where Joan is. Let me get to someplace. And we had kind of had a pact, which is good for people to do, of knowing that if a natural disaster happens, how will you reconnect with the people you love? And our plan was to pick a common point of safety and get to that point. And, you know, because there's nothing you can do with millions of people out in the street not knowing what to do. So I headed towards her parents' house up on 92nd Street. But Joan's story is actually more interesting of how she got out of the building. Did you want me to run through that?
Yeah, please. And before we move on to Joan's story, the difference between the 72nd floor, which you started on, and the 65th floor, would that have made a difference? Or what floor did the plane strike the North Tower?
The plane that hit my building hit up around the 90s or so. So pretty much at the same floor that Joan worked on.
Gotcha.
Then the plane that hit her floor hit about the 60s, just about the floor that I was on. So And the people who were on the 72nd floor that I worked with, most of them made it out alive. Some of the people who moved a little slower didn't get out of the basement and got killed. But there was 13 people for the Port Authority, I believe. Maybe more. I forget now. I think it was 13 people on my floor who may not have made it.
If the plane struck the building below where Joan was, how did she get down?
You passed it.
Past that.
Well, she was lucky enough to have a window office. And she's a very, very calm person. And when we were in the earthquake in San Francisco, she just looked out the window and said, I'm not going out. People are running around. It looks crazy. And she sat back down at the desk and kept working. So she really had something like 13 minutes to get out of the building, to get down below her floor, to get off her floor, or she would have been dead. And so what happened was she hears the bang, and the flame that shot out of the building, the one we all saw on TV, goes past her windows. And it's she described it. She said it was the brightest orange I've ever seen. And, you know, it was really, really hot. And the next thing I see is pieces of paper and things flying through the air. And, you know, she just thought, like an airplane, you're up so high, the window blows out and everybody gets sucked out the window or something. And she figured the glass was going to melt. It was so hot. So she decided she wasn't going to sit back down at the desk and keep working. She was going to get to the elevator and get down and off that floor. And that's what she did. She went to the elevator.
Elevator.
But she only got it. Well, you know, that building hadn't been hit and nobody had said what the problem was. She just knew that there was fire in the sky and the elevator was the way you go down. But the elevator only took her to 78. Sorry. And on 78, she gets out and there's a lot of people congregating in the lobby, people she knew, people she worked with, people who said, you know, hey, how you doing on the project I'm doing or something. And so, like I said, the minute
completely unaware
right now. Completely unaware. And she said, look, I'm sorry. What I saw, I'm going downstairs. I'm getting coffee. I'm going to Century 21. I'm getting out of the building right now. And I think you should, too. And those people didn't listen, and they didn't. Sorry. She got out. They didn't. Their families were calling us afterwards. What were they wearing? What do you think happened? Do you think maybe they had anemia? They're in the hospital, hoping against hope that they made it out. But she got in the elevator. She got down to 44 from 78, and then she couldn't find where the next elevator was. So she got to the stairs, and she was on about the 12th floor when the plane hit her building. And she said the lights went out, the generator kicked in, the lights came back on, dust fell down, the whole building shook. It was terrifying. And she just had to walk down the rest of those floors, the 12 of the floors. I forget exactly where she came out, but she got out with another woman. And like I said, she's very calm. And so they left the building. They apparently the woman needed to get some money, so they stopped at a teller machine. The dust was heading towards the east side, and they exited out the west and left. So they were sort of totally oblivious. They knew the building had some problem, but they were totally oblivious to the danger they were in. One of the people that she worked with decided to go back upstairs because the woman that he was walking out with had left a purse. He said, I'll go up and get it for you. And he was talking to his wife, looking out the window when the plane hit the building. And he said, you got to turn on the TV. No, I'm sorry. He was looking out the window at the first building hit, my building, and he called his wife and said, you got to look out the window and see what's, you got to look at TV and see what's going on. And the plane hit and the line went dead. Joan walked with her friend. They went and got Starbucks, believe it or not. And then they just started walking uptown. And it took her till 1 o'clock that day to give me a call at her mother's house. So I had no idea what was going on from, you know, when I first made that phone call to her family and found out that she had made it out, to 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
What were the first things you guys said to each other on that call?
Oh, she goes, you know, well, I'm almost up there. And I'm like, oh my God, where were you all this time? Why didn't you call? She said, oh, I called. I had called. And I'm like, but you called like hours ago and the building fell down and everything happened. She goes, oh, I was walking with Kula and it was taking a while. And, you know,
she
I figured
the
everyone
most
knew.
Calm person.
Seriously.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that might have saved her being calm, not freaking out.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It worked for her.
Wow.
So basically, I said, well, what block are you on and everything like that? She was on 2nd Avenue. I said, stay on 2nd Avenue. I'm running down. I'm going to meet up with you. So I'm running as fast as I can run, passing everybody, jumping over suitcases like O.J. Simpson and his commercials in the back in the day. And just before she... You know, we started to be able to have some communication by cell phone at that point. And, you know, I kind of knew she was about a block or two away. And I ran into a cafe that had an outside seating, ordered some food. It was already, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon at this point. And as she and her friend came walking up, I said, would you ladies like to join me for some lunch? And then we spent, pretty much a good part of that next couple hours fielding phone calls from family, from people who worked in the building, who worked for me. And the last person that worked for me, we found out was alive about 9 o'clock that night.
Wow.
So that was our reuniting. And pretty much, you know, the end of that day, for us.
Did you guys ever return to New York to work?
Yes, yes. On the 13th, 2 days later, we decided that we wanted to get as far away as Manhattan as possible. We didn't know what was going to happen. The headlines on the 13th were the first war of the 21st century. We talked about using all weapons at our disposal, and we just felt like, oh, my God, the world is done. I thought it was going to be like those movies of World War II where, you know, they're bombing England and people are just walking around in the streets. You know, we were never going to see the sun again. Who knows? You know, you always have a certain amount of post-stress syndrome when something like this happens. So we left Manhattan. We actually decided just a couple of days after that to move out of the city completely and settle. I guess it was a month afterwards. November 1st, we moved into a small town in upstate New York, Essex, New York, 700 people. We were New Yorkers through and through, had really never lived outside of a city. And we did that for 7 years, but I started commuting back to the city, kind of got a pied-à-terre apartment. And I also, when we were getting a new office and I got to kind of pick where the office would be, it ended up being right over Grand Central Station at a two Penn Plaza. So, you know, we should have been smarter, I suppose, but thank God they never attacked Grand Central Terminal.
Yeah. It's a really unbelievable story. How's Joan now?
Luckily, we both get out with our health. We both avoided sucking in the dust that after the fact killed so many people. I mean, one good bit of advice for anybody who's in any kind of natural disaster is, of course, help anybody you can, do anything you can for people, but get as far away as you can. I mean, sometimes the thing that kills you is not the immediate event, but all the stuff that happens afterwards.
Right.
We were the lucky ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bruce, thank you so much for coming on and sharing that. We really appreciate it.
No problem. Hopefully it'll help other people who might be in the same situation. And thanks for asking.
Oh, thank you, Bruce Steppen, 9/11 survivor. 99.1 PLR, 95.9 The Fox, Chaz and AJ in the morning. This guy was buried under the rubble of the South Tower for 13 hours. Will
Jimeno.
What?
Jimeno.
Yeah.
Jimeno.
Jimeno. Yep, Jimeno.
Exactly.
Jimeno. All right. I apologize.
Oh, no worries.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Take us through that day.
Well, September 11th, you know, was just a normal day. I was living the American dream. I just bought my first house 6 weeks before the attack. I had a beautiful wife named Dallas, and she was 7 months pregnant. I had a little girl, 4 years old, Bianca, and I was living my dream as being a police officer for the Port Authority Police of New York and New Jersey.
Oh, thank you for
went
your
to work
service.
In Midtown Manhattan at the bus terminal. And, you know, just a normal day, and next thing you know, we're being called down to the World Trade Center because the World Trade Center is under attack.
What was going through your mind? That had to be the most memorable call you ever received.
Well, you know what? I didn't see the first plane, but it came over the bus terminal. I saw the shadow of it cover the 42nd 8th Avenue. Once we got called back to the police station, we saw the TV set, and we saw that the tower was on fire.
When you saw that shadow, Will, why do you remember that, you think? Was that not something you would normally see?
No, actually, I just looked over because I was standing under an awning, and I looked over and I saw Sergeant Ross pointing up in the air, one of our sergeants, and I happened to look out to 42nd 8th Avenue, and as everybody knows, that's a big intersection, and it just went dark. I mean, literally, I didn't hear the plane, but I saw this shadow, and it just covered the whole intersection, which was weird, but I didn't really pay much attention to it, and
right.
Then, you know, our radios crackled, so told us to come back to the police desk.
Yeah. And then you get the call.
We all get the call. 20 of us got on a commandeered bus and headed down to the World Trade Center to help our brothers and sisters from the Port Authority Police in evacuations.
And then what happened?
Well, when we got there, it was, you know, I stepped off the bus and, you know, I served in the military as U.S. Navy, and I never thought I'd see war on U.S. soil, but here we were. It was a war zone. You know, I call it like Armageddon. You know, both buildings were on fire, papers flying everywhere. And unfortunately, you know, there were people jumping from the first tower, and they were jumping, holding hands by themselves. And, you know, as a cop, our job's to help people. And I felt so small because we're standing in front of these humongous buildings and they're on fire and people are jumping to their deaths. Luckily, I had Sergeant McLaughlin, experienced ESU Officer Port Authority, which is emergency service, and a good boss. Asked for volunteers. Myself, Dominic Pizzullo, and Christopher, and Antonio Rodriguez volunteered. And we went into the towers to try to rescue people. We met up with another officer, Christopher Moroso, where there's a famous picture of him from the Daily News, and we became a team of five. We were leaving Tower 2 to go to Tower 1 because, unfortunately for us, we didn't know that en route from Midtown Manhattan to Downtown Manhattan, a second plane had hit. So we thought Tower 1 was the only one on fire. So as we were making our way underneath the World Trade Center in the mall level, we were halfway from Tower 2 to Tower 1 when the first tower collapsed. And unfortunately, it took the life of Antonio Rodriguez and Christopher Hermoso, leaving myself, my sergeant, and my fellow officer, Dominic Pizzullo, buried alive at that moment.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
So did you hear the sound of the tower collapsing? And, what was that like? Did you have any kind of a warning that the building was coming down?
No. You know, my sergeant always says, if I thought the buildings were coming down, I would have never taken you guys in there. Actually, we were working our way from Tower 2 to Tower 1 when we heard a humongous boom, and I turned around and looked from where we were walking back into the lobby of 2, and I saw a fireball, the size of my house. Fortunately for us, we were standing next to a doorway that led to a freight elevator, and thank goodness my sergeant's very experienced. He actually saw the debris wall coming at us. I didn't see it. So he thought, let me get my team around the corner to that freight elevator. Hopefully, if I can get my team there, the elevator shafts, the beams might deflect some of this explosion. We never knew the towers were coming down. He thought it was a car bomb. And his quick thinking at least initially saved three of us, himself and me and Dominic Pizzullo. Unfortunately, when the second tower came down, we lost Dominic Pizzullo, leaving my sergeant and me alive. And at that point, it was really just a fight for our lives for many, many hours. And it was torturous, horrible. You know, we had fireballs falling in. We had a weapon go off because Dominic, before he passed, actually pulled his sidearm out and pointed up into a hole that was letting light in and shot one round. It was a last-ditch effort for someone to know that we were down there. In his last moments, he was thinking about the team. So a lot of bad things happened down there, you know, things that I hope nobody will ever have to go through again. But you know what? We're the two people that survived from underneath the World Trade Center. I was buried for 13 hours, my sergeant for 22. And the one thing I can tell people 20 years later is that, you know, the terrorists, or as I call them, the cowards, thought they were going to win that day. They didn't win. Good people won that day. And me and my sergeant are a testament to that, that two human beings can have 220 stories fall on them and still survive. So the terrorists didn't understand that. They thought they were going to bring us to our knees. What they did was make us stronger and bring us together.
Were you pinned completely, or like, did you have any like room to move at all where you were?
No, I was pinned completely. I had a wall, what I know today, literally fall on my entire left side.
Oh.
So all I had was movement of my right arm and part of my left arm, but I couldn't move at all. I was stuck, and it was just torturous because, you know, again, fireballs were falling in and you couldn't move. So my right arm was starting to get burned. It was a long, long 13 hours. One that I always tell people, if take your worst nightmare and multiply by probably a trillion, that might come close to how bad it was down there.
How were you able to breathe? Well, clearly, but yeah. How tough was
it? Yeah, it was. No, that was a great question because, you know what, I think we just became part of the building, believe it or not. When my rescue workers got in there, Scott Strauss, Patty McGee from NYPD ESU, and Chuck Sharika, a civilian paramedic that came off the street, they were choking. They could barely, you know, breathe down there. Meanwhile, me and my sergeant, I think we just started breathing everything in. When they pulled me out, it was days later, I still had a tube down my throat, and I could actually see rocks coming out of my lungs, which is incredible what the human body can withstand and what it can do.
This is really a miracle. Of this is a miracle.
Seriously.
That you weren't killed in the under the debris.
Right.
But were able to live after
Didn't
breathing
suffocate
and all
afterwards.
That.
Yeah.
Were you
yeah,
able...
Yeah, the smoke was intense. Say again?
No, no. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, it's incredible what the human body can take. I mean, you know, we joke about it today, but my sister, when she was young, I ended up by accident breaking her ankle. And she had asked the doctors, I guess, 2 weeks afterwards, like, you know, how many bones did Will break? And the doctor said, I didn't break any bones. So when you talk about a miracle, not only did I survive, I came out without any broken bones. I took a serious injury to my left leg. You know, it's my left leg was crushed. It doesn't operate well today. I have a lot of big scars, and I have a drop foot, so I have to wear a brace. But amazingly, I didn't break any bones, you know, and my sister's upset about that because I broke her ankle when we were kids. So,
what are you going to do?
I tell people, you know what? Out of a tragedy, you got to find some humor, too, because if you don't have a humor, it'll drive you crazy.
Yeah, you're lost. Right. Yeah, big time. How's your overall health, though? I mean, you breathed in a lot of the stuff.
You know what? Knock on wood, and I'm knocking on wood right now. I've been healthy. My sergeant has had some issues, nothing major. My rescue workers have had many issues. And, you know, it's something that's over my shoulder. I'm always wondering, when is 9/11 still going to come get us? Because that's how we feel as rescue workers. For those that were down there and those that help recover people, first responders, the iron workers, everybody, you know, 9/11 is something that lives with us every single day. And we've lost more people now, I believe, as far as rescue workers than we lost that day. And that's
right.
A sad deal. You know, and I want people to remember that 9/11, for those of us that survived it, that lived through it, it's something that doesn't go away just because it's a 10th anniversary, 20th anniversary. We're living with that every day. So,
I want
people to remember 9/11.
Yep.
Your sergeant, Will, when you guys were both under the debris, were you able to talk to each other? Were you close? Did you know he was alive?
Oh, absolutely. Where I was buried, if you look down toward my feet, all I could see was concrete. We were in a very small void. He was like literally 10 feet from me, but I couldn't see him. He was buried behind concrete. I always say if I didn't have him, I don't know if I would have survived because we really leaned on each other for, support. You know, I leaned on him for his knowledge. He leaned on me for making sure he didn't fall asleep, and we kept each other going all night long.
What kind of stuff were you saying to each other?
You know, first and foremost, I would lean on him for his knowledge as a police officer. And, you know, I said, Sarge, you know, what do we do next? You know, what training? And he's like, there's never been a book written about this. We're basically going to have to live on our wits. We're going to have to survive. We would talk about our families. We got to know each other because at that point, I only knew him as Sergeant McLaughlin. He knew me as Jimeno. We ended up talking on first name basis, talking about our families. We prayed. We prayed a lot. And that's what kept us going, you know, is that love for each other as police officers, as Americans, as human beings.
When the folks came that got you out, you were buried for 13 hours and your sergeant, I think 22, you said?
Yes, sir.
When the rescuers were getting close, was there a dialogue back and forth with them?
Yes, it was around 8 p.m. that night when I heard someone yell, United States Marine Corps, can anybody hear us yell or tap? I started just yelling at the top of my lungs. They made their way to me and found me. There was a little hole, on my left side, which I didn't know was there. It took them about 5 minutes to find me because I had become part of the building. And I was waving my hand. The flashlight was in my hand, but they couldn't see me. Finally, I mustered enough spit on my hand that I could get some of the dust off, and that's when they said, we got you. And, you know, I was so thankful. Being a Navy guy that carried Marines in the U.S. Navy on the USS Tripoli, I yelled at him. I'm like, hey, I was in the Gator Navy. I carried you guys. Don't leave us. And they told us, we're not going to leave you. We're Marines.
That's
and,
awesome.
You know, at that point, I thought, we're at war. You know, the Marine Corps here.
In New York City.
Yep.
In
yeah,
New York
which
City.
Is crazy, you know?
It is.
Then I'm guessing you told them, get my sergeant.
When they got in the hole, the first thing I said was, please get my partner out. You know, we're swollen. We're suffering from compartment syndrome, which makes your body literally become like the Michelin man. Your muscles are dying. You're not thinking right. So when they got into the hole, I had my fellow officer, Dominic Pazullo, who had passed, was right next to me. So I kept saying, please get to my partner. And they thought I was talking about Dominic. They just said, look, we got to get you out first. And they were working on me for about 3 hours. And probably halfway through that rescue, my sergeant was silent. But halfway through, he says, "How's it going out there?" And that freaked them out. They're like, "Who's that?"
Right.
And I'm like, "That's my partner." And that's when I realized they thought. And actually, Scott Strass tells it the story the best. You know, he says to me, "Who's that?" I said, "Well, that's my partner." And he said, "Well, I thought this was your partner." And I said, "No, you know, that's Dominic. He's passed." And that freaked them out, you know, like out of the depths of nowhere, there's another voice. But luckily for me, they had trained with my sergeant. Again, Port Authority Police, we have all the major transportation facilities and the NYPD. So we cross-trained with each other. So they knew him. And that was very, very good for me because I felt like, okay, these aren't only cops and brothers in blue, but they actually know my sergeant. And that meant a lot at that moment.
That's great. So you get out 13 hours in, which is an incredible stretch of time. They bring you right to the hospital?
Yes, they took me to Bellevue Hospital, and that was difficult because the first time I cried that night was when they pulled me out of the hole because I looked up and I didn't see the buildings. And I said, "Where is everything?" And they said, "It's all gone, kid." And I felt like we failed. Then they took me to Bellevue, and second time I cried was they got me off the ambulance, and I'm like, "Where is everybody?" Because all these doctors and nurses are standing around at around, I think, quarter to 12 at night. And they just said to me, "You're it." And I couldn't believe that. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, what are you talking about? There's thousands of people. Because, again, unfortunately and fortunately, we're the only two to survive from underneath the World Trade Center. So I knew I could see how many people were still in that mall level, in that concourse area. And that was difficult for me to swallow, that I'm alive and so many people are dead.
Wow. You're it.
Yep.
Yeah, and thank goodness, you know, my sergeant came out the next morning, and then the last person pulled out was topside Mrs. Guzman, who was also a Port Authority employee. So there was 18 of us that survived, and like I say, 20 years later, I want people to remember that the terrorists didn't win. We won because, you know, we went in to help people and found ourselves in distress, and people put their lives on the line. And that's why I always love the quote by Edmund Burke, the British philosopher: "All that is needed for the triumph of evil is for good men to stand by and do nothing." But on September 11th, there were good men and women, and today they're good men and women. And I just feel it's our obligation to teach a new generation that the good of that day, because for this generation today, September 11th is what Pearl Harbor was to me as a child.
Will, have you been in since the attack 20 years ago, have you been in a room with the 18 survivors and talked about your experiences and how you feel?
I have met several of the survivors, from Dave Lim, who was in a stairwell with the 13 other people, the firefighter Jay Jonas, and Mrs. Guzman I've met. So I've had the pleasure of meeting other survivors, and it's always, we're family. You know, I've done something with the group 911day.org. You can go there if you want to do something on September 11th. That's really good, 911day.org. And I've met other survivors. And, you know, they call us the 9/11 community. I didn't know we had a name. But I'm blessed to meet those people, people that got away from the building, people that survived. And there's a close-knit love there because, again, the one thing about September 11th is that was a day we saw the most evil that can happen. But at the same time, it was a day that we saw the most love. I can tell you as a survivor, in those towers, there was love. There were people from different races, colors, ethnicities, political stands that just cared about each other. And that's what I want 20 years later. I want people to remember, unfortunately, to use the term September 12th, the day after September 11th, when the world came together. You know, they didn't only attack America. They attacked the world. They attacked humanity. And we're better than that as people. And I want future generations to understand that they're our future leaders, and take the lessons from September 11th, but take the good lessons from that day and lead us in a good direction.
Man, you are the man.
Yep.
You are really inspiring.
Very.
To, after everything that happened to you and being right there at the center of it all, to remind everybody that it was some greatness that came out of all of this after the attack. And
exactly.
They did not win.
Nope.
Will has two
books.
Well,
you know, I just tell people that it's my job and my obligation as a survivor. That's why I wrote in two books, Immigrant American Survivor, the children's book, and Sunrise to the Darkness, to help people that are dealing with their darknesses, you know, and I'm proud that they're both being carried at the 9/11 Museum store as well as Amazon.com. You know, Immigrant American Survivor tells my tale as an immigrant coming to this country, my dreams, my love for this nation, what happened on September 11th to teach children. And Sunrise Through the Darkness, again, is a book that, and it's for everybody, that when you're dealing with your darkness, because I had to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder after 9/11, I've been able to find my happiness, my sunrise. And I want to just share the things that I learned from September 11th with children and adults. And that's why I'm so proud that, you know, I was able to write two books, you know, one children's book and one book for adults. So I hope people check them out, Sunrise Through the Darkness and Immigrant American Survivor, both on Amazon.com and at the 9/11 Museum, which I'm very proud of.
Will Jimeno, thank you for coming on. It's an honor to talk to you. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. And that's everybody in Connecticut, God bless you.